from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It's been 2.5 years since Japan's Fukushima nuclear plant was rocked by earthquake and tsunami and melted down. The world's worst nuclear disaster since Chernobyl. And whenever there's news from Fukushima, it's been more bad news. Things worse than imagined or earlier told. Rube Goldberg, crazy quilt fixes, radiation pouring into the Pacific. If the latest plan to freeze the coastline to hold in contaminated water sounds desperate, maybe it is. This hour on Point, the nuclear mess at Fukushima, how far it may reach, and what needs to be done. You can join us on air or online where this conversation never ends. What's the answer to this calamity? What's the lesson in this mess? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Here's a little sound. Last week, residents of towns around Fukushima that are allowed to visit their homes get to go a maximum of 10 times a year. They're brief visits wearing protective uniforms and masks. CBS reporter Seth Doan traveled to the town of Okuma with former resident Akira Okuwara and visited his home.
These are streets you drove down your whole life. What goes through your mind now driving toward your old home?
It used to be a very beautiful place, he told us. It makes me very, very sad. I want people around the world to understand what Fukushima is facing, he told us, and how we're still suffering.
And the nuclear plant, wounded nuclear plant, causing all this? Still a mountain of mysteries and unknowns. Here was Shunichi Tanaka, president of Japan's Nuclear Regulatory Authority, at a news conference just last Wednesday, admitting the government still has no clear idea of how much contaminated water has leaked from holding tanks on the site. Here he is, interpreted by Agence France-Presse.
We don't know what the situation is exactly, how big the leak was, how radioactive it was, or where it was going.
How big, how radioactive, or where it was going. In other words, we don't know a whole lot. Joining me first today from Tokyo is David McNeil. He reports for The Economist and The Independent. He's co-author of Strong in the Rain, Surviving Japan's Earthquake, Tsunami, and Fukushima Nuclear Disaster. And he's just back from a visit to Fukushima. David, welcome. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
I mean, it just seems like it's always worse than we've been told. Describe for us the situation there now, David, with all these holding tanks, hundreds of tons being captured in them every day, some of them leaking, and I guess they're continuing to build more. What's going on there?
Well, as you know, the tsunami and earthquake of 2.5 years ago caused shut down the cooling system to the power plant, and that led to the meltdown of three of the reactors. And there's three huge blobs, 100 tons plus, of melted uranium fuel in the bottom of those reactors. And the only way that they can keep it cool is by pouring water on it every day, and that goes on 24 hours, and it has gone on since this disaster began. And, of course, that water, when it touches the fuel, becomes radioactive. Now, what they're trying to do is to decontaminate that water as much as they can, but it's only partially decontaminated, and then it's stored in these tanks. So if you go onto the site, you see that the only thing that appears to have changed in the last 2 years on site, apart from sort of cleaning up the debris, is that these tanks have mushroomed. There are now about 1,100 of them. They hold 1,000 tons of water each. They're makeshift. They're, in some cases, not put together very well. This is what we've learned in the last couple of months, of course. Some of the joints are made with sealant, and the sealant, it's believed, is corroding because of the radiation. And one of those joints, at least, as far as we know, has leaked radioactive water. Now, what's sort of astonishing from the point of view of people who are looking at what's going on is that TEPCO, despite all of these problems, still seems to have these real gaps in its knowledge about what it's doing. So, for example, it took it a long time, days, possibly even weeks, to notice that 300 tons of highly radioactive water had leaked from one of those tanks. And what we learned this week is that they're scrambling now to try and find workers who can monitor those tanks, because they had a very small team of people going around the power plant checking them, and they were visually checking them. They don't actually have any gauges on these tanks, so they're very prone to leaks, and what we suspect is that this leak that we had recently is not a one-off, but it may point to a generic problem of leaks at the power plant. And that's the really scary part of this latest phenomenon.
So TEPCO, Tokyo Electric Power Company, the company that owns this and has been in charge of the cleanup. I'm looking at aerial view of Fukushima here, the plant, and much of it looks familiar, except for, as you say, this giant tank farm that's grown around it, 400 tons of cooling water being collected in tanks each day. So this farm continues to grow. This does not sound at all like a sustainable operation. You've called this, a machine for generating radioactive water. That doesn't sound too good.
Yes. Well, that's not my phrase. A lot of people have called it a machine for generating radioactive water. And as you say, it doesn't appear to be sustainable. And in fact, the NRA chairman who you just quoted, Tanaka-san, he actually said for the first time yesterday at a press conference that TEPCO will have to release some of this water into the sea. And what he said was that the water would be decontaminated to acceptable international standards, that the radioactive release would not be harmful to the environment. But really, we only have his word for that and the word of TEPCO. And there are also lots of sort of suggestions about ways to keep this fuel cool. One of them is that it could be air-cooled, but that means that the entire system that they have used, that TEPCO has used for cooling this nuclear fuel for the last 2.5 years, would have to be changed. And they would also have to call in a lot of international help, including help from America. And so far, there doesn't seem to be much sign that that's happening.
So we've got this proliferation of tanks full of radioactive water, just tons and tons and tons and hundreds of tons. And then, something like an underground river running under the plant here, which they're worried about carrying that leaking radioactive water out to sea by. And the news today that the government will put up something like $500 million, the equivalent thereof, to build an ice wall to stop this water from running into the sea. How's that work, David?
Well, there's two separate problems, if you like. One is the water that they're using to cool the uranium fuel, and the other problem is water that's running into the power plant from the surrounding hills and mountains and whenever it rains. And that water becomes groundwater, and it gets contaminated when it touches the contaminated water. It mixes with the contaminated water. And, of course, it's leaking into the sea, and what's really making people angry is that TEPCO for months denied that it was leaking into the sea and has only recently come clean. So the problem of what to do with all this water sloshing around the plant is really the headache, if you like, of the moment. And of course, there is another set of problems which in some ways is even more challenging, because what the engineers have to do once they get this leak problem fixed is they have to find a way to extract this highly radioactive nuclear fuel, and also to dismantle a fuel pool in the damaged Reactor 4 building. There's 1,500 fuel rods in the damaged 4 reactor building, which have to be extracted one by one. Again, highly radioactive, a massive engineering job before they can decommission this plant. So, it's only one, but really the leaking water is only one of a number of headaches. Now, what the government has done today is it has given a total of $470 million or it's promised that to TEPCO to try and fix the most immediate problem, which is leaking water. And they will build, we're told what they'll do is they'll build this artificial wall, an ice wall, around the most damaged reactors in a bid to keep the groundwater, groundwater that's leaking into the plant from coming into contact with contaminated water that's been used to cool the fuel rods. And it's anybody's guess, really, if that will work. I'm sure engineers, nuclear engineers on your program later on will be better qualified to comment on that.
I mean, it sounds like science fiction, something out of a Marvel comic book, a giant ice wall to hold back the poison. And the politics here, David, you've got Prime Minister Abe at the head of a pro-nuclear power party in power in Japan. What difference has that made in the way the national government in Tokyo is looking at this, talking about it?
Well, I mean, I think the main difference, as far as we can tell from our perspective, is that, first of all, there is this suspicion that the government and the regulators have taken their eye off the Daiichi power plant a little bit because they are concerned about restarting the other commercial reactors in Japan as quickly as possible.
They shut down, all 50 or 60 of them after Daiichi, Fukushima?
meltdown.
That's right. So they've all been shut down sort of not immediately after Fukushima, but as a result of Fukushima, the safety checks have become much more stringent. And, of course, each the restart of each power plant has become a political issue in each host town, host prefecture where they're based. And that has slowed down these restarts. So, yes, as you say, all 50 commercial reactors will be offline or are actually offline this month. That makes Japan nuclear-free for the first, for the second time, I should say, since 1971 or 1972.
How long are we talking for this nuclear zone around the power plant here? You know, 10 more years, 50 more years, 100 more years?
Well, that's anybody's guess as well. I mean, I've just been up there, and what's very clear is, first of all, that the estimated contamination levels that the government is giving based on these reading points massively underestimates the amount of radiation that there is up there. The radiation is falling, but very, very slowly. The government is spending billions of dollars to try and decontaminate the areas immediately around the power plant that were homes to. They were home to about 160,000 people. But most of the people that we talk to who are from those areas believe that they will never go back. Of course, there are some old people who will return, but in general, people say they don't have a hope of going home.
David McNeil in Tokyo, reporting there for The Economist and The Independent, co-author of Strong in the Rain. Thank you very much for getting us started today, David. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the big mess at Japan's Fukushima nuclear plant, the Daiichi plant, how far it could spread, and what it's going to take to clean it up. Joining us now from Tokyo is Yoichi Funabashi. He was chairman of the Rebuild Japan Initiative Foundation, program director of the Independent Investigation Commission on the Fukushima Daiichi Nuclear Accident, former editor-in-chief of the big daily newspaper Asahi Shimbun in Tokyo. Mr. Funabashi, thank you very much for joining us again at On Point. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me. Thank you very much.
And with us today from Berkeley, California, is Per Peterson. He's chair of the Department of Nuclear Engineering at University of California, Berkeley. Per Peterson, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
Yoichi Funabashi, we talked with you more than a year ago. You tell us, and you've come out with a very critical report about how things were handled, what led to this, and the response. Is this getting better? Is Japan getting on top of this crisis at Fukushima or not, Mr. Funabashi?
Well, unfortunately, we still are in crisis, even though the government's a long time ago declared ending the crisis, but as illustrated in the most recent leakage issues, that they have to, the operator still have to pour 400 tons onto the over the reactors every day, and then they have to deal with this contaminated water somehow.
Mm-hmm.
So, and 150,000 people are still in evacuation. So I think that we are still in a very, very serious situation.
What is public opinion in Japan about this disaster and how it's been handled? I mean, after all, Prime Minister Abe's in power. His government is pro-nuclear power.
Oh, Prime Minister Abe and this government certainly seems to be very much eager to restart that the nuclear plants. And as soon as possible. But unless and until they really have to address this Fukushima nuclear mess, they just cannot get that public approval. And the public also is so much frustrated with that inept handling of that TEPCO on this issue. So more than 90% of the public people now demand that the government really should be in charge of dealing with this.
Per Peterson in California, you know a lot about nuclear engineering. What's your sort of big take on the story of this nuclear plant and how the crisis has been handled?
I think that the big story here is that the crisis clearly is not being handled as well as it should be. In the United States, we had an accident at the Three Mile Island plant, and within 2 years, water had been managed and treated And the process is to actually remove damaged fuel so that you would be able to ultimately decommission the plant was already underway. So the key question here is, while this is a technically more challenging set of problems at Fukushima, the technologies are much better today also to manage these challenges. So what is going on that is diverting effort from key actions such as removing the water that's in the reactor buildings so that we can stop degradation of critical structures that are needed to get the fuel out? I think that the key problem that actually that we're facing is one of difficulty in Japan because of loss of confidence in the regulator in making decisions based on risk. Much of the water that has been treated at the plant mm-hmm. is within regulatory standards. The decision to not release water and instead to store all of it doesn't have a basis in public health or environmental protection. And by not discharging water and instead storing it, of course, a lot of resources and effort is being diverted to activities which really are not helpful from the perspective of addressing particularly the long-term risk. In order to remove the fuel from those reactors, as we did at TMI, it will be necessary to flood up in the primary containment vessels with water so that all of the work to open the reactor vessel and to remove the material can be done underwater to keep material from being mobilized and to provide radiation shielding.
Yeah.
Today, the critical structure that needs to be repaired is the primary containment vessel. It's being left submerged in salty water and is corroding. So by not making prudent decisions today about what water must be discharged and what water can be safely discharged and instead just storing it all, the risk is that it will make it in the longer term much less likely that it'll be possible to get the damaged fuel out. And so by misdirecting a lot of the effort mm-hmm. to do things that don't reduce risk significantly, they're creating in Japan a much larger probability that in the end it will not be possible to get the damaged fuel out, and they will have to manage those plants at that site for millennia going into the future.
Millennia, that means thousands of years. We've got this sort of sorcerer's apprentice vision right now, this tank farm just growing like Topsy, bigger and bigger. They're saving all this water because it is radioactive, but you're saying, what, just dump it in the Pacific and get into those pools and get the fuel rods out of there?
Believe it or not, much of the water that is being stored has actually been cleaned to the point where it meets fully all international standards for discharge. There is also water, of course, at the site that has not been fully processed because they have to store it and then process it.
Yeah.
But the majority of the water at the site actually would be safe to discharge. The decision to not do so has been a political decision that regulatory agencies around the world question.
Mr. Funabashi, if there's so much quote-unquote safe water here, why is Japan now spending $500 million to build an ice wall to contain runoff water here?
Well, I think that really reveals that to the extent that the situation has gotten worse and worse. But I think that we also should think of that the political environment, which has been changing so much the former government, DPJ, was ousted
mm-hmm.
With a new government coming into power. And also, a year ago, former regulatory agencies were all disbanded. And then we have had this new nuclear regulation authority and agency, the new regulatory body, and they have been just forming. They have gradually, formed into a more established institution. So we are all having in transition, and TEPCO also has been in a limbo financially, and there are much lack of cash and financial resources to deal with that. So everything. All that measures have been somewhat a makeshift, temporary, And they have not really established a more sustainable long-term solution to deal with that waters and the others.
Per Peterson, is it? I mean, Japan's a big, smart country. How can it deal with such an apparent crisis in a makeshift way? I mean, is it because there's not such a terrible risk here after all? You can just tend it for thousands of years. This is expensive, but there's no threat to life and limb. Or are they ignoring or papering over a big threat? What's the worst case scenario here?
Well, I think that the Japanese regulatory system has had some significant problems before, during, and after the accident. And much of it has been around the ability to make decisions to focus on activities that really are important for risk management. For example, during the course of the accident, decisions were made to delay the venting of the containment vessels at the plant. And this was the things that contributed to these decisions involve concerns and a lot of political feedback into the decision-making process that included activities, you know, decisions made at the prime minister's level.
Yeah.
The tragic thing is that because those vessels were therefore allowed to exceed their design pressure, that is what caused the majority of the cesium and iodine to leak out, as well as the hydrogen that got into these reactor buildings and that provided the source for the explosions that occurred in buildings 1 and 2. And so the inability to make the right decision and take actions that were really important with respect to reducing risk was actually the principal reason why the site is highly contaminated at this point. I think today we face a similar set of problems. The lack of ability to discharge treated water that meets international standards because of essentially it's a political, not a technical decision, is causing delays in key actions that are really important if you're actually going to get the damaged fuel out of the reactors in the longer term and not have to entomb that material.
We got that. Yeah. But could you just state for us in very plain terms the big risks here? Now, one you've laid out is that it gets so out of control they can't fix it and they have to just tend and sort of entomb the whole thing and tend it for thousands of years. That's very costly. What about risks to health in plain terms in the immediate vicinity and more broadly, maybe very broadly?
So currently, they're using very good approaches to manage these risks. Because you have high levels of contamination, you have to exclude people from around the site and control their exposures. They're also treating water using very effective technologies to strip out cesium and iodine. One of the reasons that there are been delays in the decisions to release water is that there's also tritium in this water. But the truth is that the tritium
much longer lasting. I mean, there you're into your millennia again.
No, well, actually, the tritium will decays away in periods of 100 to 200 years.
Okay.
But the thing about the tritium is that it's tritium is generated in the operation of reactors worldwide in small amounts. The quantities that are actually would be released with this water are quite small compared to what is released worldwide in any given year. So one of the I think key problems is that by not being willing to discharge water that has been cleaned to standards that are sufficient to meet international standards, and instead storing it, what's happening is you're losing there at the site the opportunity to really focus on the more highly contaminated water and equally importantly to fix these reactors and to get the damaged fuel out of them in an expeditious way.
Is there still a meltdown risk here? And if so, how long will that risk be present?
So the meltdown risk now is essentially gone from these reactors in the sense that the amount of heat being generated in this fuel immediately after these reactors were shut down was very large because of all of the short-lived radioactive species.
Yep.
Today, the only significant heat source that is in that fuel is small amounts of cesium, and the amount of heat that's being generated today is orders of magnitude lower than it was immediately after the accident.
What would happen if they stopped bathing this thing in water? What would happen?
So the analysis that I saw that was performed shortly after the accident asked that question because you wanted to know if you were to not cool it, how long would it be before the decay had been sufficient that things would not be a problem? Mm-hmm. At that time, I think that the numbers were saying that probably after about 16 months, the heat generation rates would be sufficient that if you didn't cool the fuel, it would not heat up to temperatures that would cause further damage or melting. Now, that doesn't mean that it doesn't make sense to continue to flush water through these reactors to keep them cool. And also, you want to be trying to flush out all of that salt that was injected into these reactors, which right now is contributing to the corrosion of these primary containment vessels.
Right.
That if they don't survive, it will become challenging or impossible to get the damaged fuel out.
And this giant and growing tank farm of contaminated water around it. Per Peterson, please stand by in Berkeley, and Yoichi Funabashi in Tokyo. So happy to have both of you here. With us right now from Woods Hole, Massachusetts, is Ken Bissler, senior scientist in marine chemistry at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute. He's been studying radioactive contamination in the Pacific Ocean and its fish stocks. Been tracking radioactive leaks from Fukushima since the beginning, and he was just there in May. He'll be back there again to take new readings next week. Ken Bissler, thank you very much for joining us.
Tom, thank you for inviting me.
You're quoted here by the BBC saying, this thing is not over by a long shot. Chernobyl was in many ways a one-week fire explosive event, nothing with the potential of this, Fukushima right on the ocean. What have you seen about contamination in the immediate vicinity? Is it traveling far afield? What's the risk here?
Well, we've known since 2011 that there was still a persistent leak from the site. Nowhere near as big as what was going on in March and April of 2011, so we do have to put some perspective here.
Yep.
For some of the main isotopes of concern, the cesium isotopes, there was a lot more released thousands of times in that year of 2011 than there is now through these leaks. So in that sense, we have a situation that's not as out of control, of course, as the accident. But then we heard earlier about the tanks. One isotope we haven't talked about, strontium-90, is high levels in some of those tanks, and that's particularly the one that leaked out. And so it wouldn't take very many of these tanks to leak to actually equal, for strontium-90, the total amount that happened was released uncontrolled into the ocean in 2011.
Is this a threat to the world's oceans, or if it all got out, would it dissipate so much that it would not be?
Well, the all got out, I'm not going to go that far. Right now, what's gotten out is unprecedented for the ocean. You know, the total quantity of the isotopes, depends which one, may have been larger in Chernobyl, but this is right on the ocean, so it was a larger direct release into the sea. That being said, the concern on land is more your direct exposure to these radiation doses we've been hearing about. In the ocean, it's more of uptake into the food chain in the internal dose, and that's because as soon as that groundwater their tank leaks get into the ocean, there's a very quick dilution process, and it does get much lower offshore. We have to use very specialized techniques to measure the quantities, even tens of kilometers, a few miles offshore, and they continue to decrease as that water moves across the Pacific. So it's a localized hotspot in the ocean with lower levels that don't cause us concern for being there. I hold radiation detectors up to make sure I'm not in harm's way on the ocean. But then the consumption of isotopes in fish is a big concern and what's caused the closing of the fisheries off of Fukushima.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking this hour at the big mess at Japan's Fukushima Daiichi nuclear plant, how far that mess could spread, and what it's going to take to ultimately, finally, clean it up. With us, Per Peterson. He's chair of the Department of Nuclear Engineering at UC Berkeley. Joins us from Berkeley, California. From Tokyo, in Japan, Yoichi Funabashi is here, chairman of the Rebuild Japan Initiative Foundation. He was program director of the Independent Investigation Commission on the Fukushima Daiichi Nuclear Accident, big critical report that his group put out. He's with us today. And from Woods Hole, the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute, Ken Bissler is with us. He's been taking samples of radioactivity off that coast in Japan and looking at the whole global picture. He joins us as well. Ken Bissler, let me come back to you on this question of how far contamination here could spread. I mean, I've got listeners, you know, writing in and saying, you know, in effect, you know, is this going to mess up my fishing off the coast of Florida or off the coast of Brazil or off the coast of Hawaii or just off the coast of Japan? How far could this go?
Well, if you think about ocean currents, you know, they're going to travel the entire distance. It might take a couple of years. We heard reports about the debris that washed up on the shores in Oregon and Washington State. Now, that came sooner because that's above water. It's blown with the wind and moves with the currents. And that's actually not radioactive from our measurements of that material. The currents are going to start showing up end of this year into next year. But the concentrations, you know, we have to remember there was cesium in the Pacific Ocean before this accident left over from the 1960s. And so by some estimates, it will go up a factor of two, a factor of five at concentrations that are nowhere near what we've seen off coastal Japan. So, you know, in terms of our health, I have no concern for those levels in the ocean, swimming, bathing, even closer to Japan. In terms of seafood, again, that's a coastal Japan issue right now. It could change as we hear about these continued leaks or different isotopes. But for the cesium isotopes that have been most prevalent and monitored and caused the closing of fisheries off Japan, that particular isotope actually becomes less and less in the body as the fish swim across. The tuna we heard about, fish that swim out, were about 20 times lower in their concentration of that cesium isotope off San Diego than off Japan. And again, at levels that were lower than some natural isotopes we don't consider harmful to us. So I'm not saying we won't be able to detect it off the west coast of the U.S., but the levels by then aren't the health concern that we have for the people living in Japan and perhaps consuming some of the seafood over there. The fisheries are closed, but that's more of a localized health concern.
Now, the cleanup has been anything but efficient so far. You know, what if it's not done well? I mean, just speak frankly about what the risks are if this goes badly or isn't well handled.
Right, and certainly there's many, many more times of these isotope inventories on land than have already reached the ocean, and we called it unprecedented. We were very concerned back in March and April of 2011 that this might get out of control and we'd have a more widespread contamination, not just in coastal fisheries, but beyond. So, you know, we're not out of the woods yet in terms of the potential, but we have to continue monitoring that and make sure not just cesium, but some of these other isotopes aren't getting into the food chain. And some of them, strontium, as I mentioned, is more of a bone-seeking isotope that doesn't leave the fish as readily. It gets in their bones, and if they are eating a small fish whole, as many of them are in Japan, then that would get into our system for much longer periods of time.
So, speak plainly about that potential risk, because this goes to people's calculations long-term about nuclear energy and how they assess risk. I mean, here this plant is, even if it's entombed for millennia, Per Petersen hopes that doesn't happen. But if it's right on the coast, it's in tsunami territory, it's in earthquake zone. If it should get, you know, let's say the whole darn thing washed into the sea, what would the global implications be, Ken?
You know, again, that's hard to say. Maybe we can ask Per Petersen about the total inventories of these isotopes. But now we're talking about something that would exceed, you know, the weapons testing I mentioned in the 60s was about 20 times larger than, say, the total cesium release from Chernobyl, which is slightly larger than Fukushima. So we're talking about something, if it's thousands of times bigger, then we do have concerns. But we don't consider the Pacific Ocean right now, before the accident, to be particularly radioactive, despite the fact that's where we conducted a lot of nuclear weapons testing. And likewise, the Irish Sea, people probably haven't heard of or forgotten about Sellafield, a reprocessing plant that's still there. And in the 60s and 70s, it released an amount of cesium that's comparable, actually, to what we've seen in Fukushima.
Ken, forgive me, but I have to persist on this point because there's a kind of, you know, I just don't hear a plain answer. If there was a quake and this thing just fell whole hog into this, the whole thing slid in. I mean, and don't write it off because who knows? Can this kind of thing contaminate a body of water as vast as the Pacific Ocean in such a way that its full food stock would be threatened and would be inedible?
It's a good question, but I find that a bit hypothetical. I think it would be hard to contaminate the entire Pacific. We just have such a huge inventory. And again, we've added in 10 to 20 times before, haven't seen detrimental effects in terms of what we consider unsafe levels. And so someone's going to have to tell me if this is going to be a million times larger or 10,000 times larger. Those things make a big difference, right, in terms of these calculations.
Per Petersen,
numbers that I don't know.
Per Petersen, speak to those numbers. You say you could dump the tanks to get in there and fix the fuel cells and entomb them, but You know, what about you're talking millennia here. In a millennia, lots of things can happen.
Correct. So the most important thing that's been happening the last couple of years is that the water treatment system technology that's been used to purify or to clean up the water that has been pumped through the plant has the capability to pick up the radioactive isotope cesium, iodide, and strontium-90 mm-hmm. on what are called ion exchange resins. They're very similar to what's been used at Hanford and at Savannah River in the United States to mm-hmm. clean up fission products and tank waste, and it was the same things that were used to clean up the water in TMI. So most of the radioactive material is actually being bound up, a large fraction of it now that is water soluble is actually bound up in these solid ion exchange resins that mm-hmm. are designed so that they can actually be used as directly as a waste form or sent to a plant like Rokasho and glassified into waste. And then it can be placed in geologic repository. The issue – so in fact, most of the radioactive inventory that was in the water is now tied up in these okay. ion exchange resins, okay. and that's the right place to get it to. The other significant inventory of radioactive material is the damaged fuel, and it's has obviously mainly radioactive species that are not that soluble in water. And if you were to leave it entombed, would only be released at very low rates over very long periods of time. Mm. So not to lead to significant, say, levels of radiation, but instead it would just be a chronic source into the ocean. And this is one of the reasons why I think that the real priority should be on advancing the efforts to get the damaged fuel out of these reactors and making pragmatic decisions about what to do with the treated water where the vast majority of the radioactive species has been stripped out into these ion exchange resins, and it meets international standards to be discharged.
Yoichi Funabashi in Tokyo, what about your assessment and those working with you at this point of the risk of radioactivity from Fukushima to Japan's food supply, ocean-based and land-based?
Well, I think so far it has not had any, a devastating impact on the food chain. Perhaps, it has contaminated already very much the seashore line. But I think that's overall. I think it still has been contained locally. That's my reading.
And how long do you expect these restrictions on fishing in that area to have to go on, Mr. Funabashi?
I don't know. I think it depends on how successful this new measures that the Japanese government just announced today will go. First, you have to decrease that amount of the contaminated water and underneath that the reactor buildings. And also surrounding trenches. That's number one. Number two, you have to keep groundwater away from that the already toxic water. And then you have to prevent the contaminated water from seeping into that ocean. And then it may take some time, but I think it's long overdue. But finally, that Japanese government now has made it very clear that they have to be in charge, and they will pay for that whole operation. So I think that's the first step.
Let's go to a caller here, Jethro, in Bourne, Massachusetts. Jethro, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I have a question for Mr. Funabashi, which is, what does he think it would take for the frustration in the Japanese public to turn into a more engaged and sustained political activism as far as changing energy policy and reliance on nuclear energy? I ask that because there was quite a lot of activism in the wake of the accident, and indeed the government's changed, but overall policy hasn't changed, and I feel that the activism has died down.
Let's put that to Yoichi Funabashi. Yoichi, what do you say?
Well, I think that the political parties, the ruling party as well as the opposition party, have failed in framing that issues to really address this crisis, and people, particularly in that last two elections, we had the general election last December, and then most recently that upper house election in last July. And in neither case, that's the major political parties were so much afraid of addressing these issues because it so could be so divisive and polarizing within its own ranks and within own parties. So the people actually did not was not provided opportunities to vote on these issues. So I think that the issues are still, after 2 years and a half, we have not seen any national consensus on these most critical issues. You know, how far we still will develop that and depend on that nuclear energy, and in what way we will dismantle and this vesture from the nuclear energy dependence. And there's no consensus, even at this point after 2 years and a half.
Even as this reactor sits in all its distress. Dick in Nashville, Tennessee. Dick, you're on the air.
Hi. You know, I used to live in Los Angeles, and we lived in a neighborhood for 15 years, and then we found out there was the worst nuclear accident happened in 1959, 2 miles from where we lived, and it still has not been cleaned up. They don't plan on cleaning it up for another 10 years.
So?
Well, I just think America should be aware that we have the problem in our own country where we don't clean up our nuclear accidents.
Yeah, I mean, look, absolutely, problems all over the place. In the cleanup in Japan, if they should take the path that you suggest, what, they got to go in there underwater, up in these cooling towers, saw these fuel rods down to size, entomb them, and then do what with them, Per?
Well, the debris that comes out of the reactor would be handled in very similar ways to the normal spent fuel, and most likely would be placed ultimately into geologic disposal. As one would spent fuel, although the Japanese also have a reprocessing plant at Rokkasho-Mura, which could be used to treat this damaged fuel. At Three Mile Island, the work was done underwater, and the damaged fuel was broken and cut up into smaller pieces, placed into canisters, and then actually transported to Idaho National Laboratory so that they could inspect it inside hot cells. And much of our understanding of severe accident phenomenology and many of the engineered features that are in the plants to mitigate the consequences, unfortunately, not used correctly during the Fukushima accident, but that knowledge comes from this experience at TMI. And the cleanup at TMI, I think, provides a lot of good models for what needs to be done at Fukushima. But things such as delaying the pumping of the water out of the reactor buildings and leaving critical equipment immersed in corrosive water is, I think, showing that there's a misdirection of the effort there towards activities that really don't reduce risk as much as you could by focusing on getting the damaged fuel out of the reactors.
Ken Bissler, there you are at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute. What do you think of the idea of pumping that water out into the sea so they can get in to deal with the core issue? Does it look safe to you to do that?
Well, I think there's a wide range in contamination levels. I know they can't even take clean groundwater upstream and put that in the ocean because of opposition from some of the local fisheries groups. The tank we heard about that leaked the other day, that had extremely high levels of some of the beta emitters, including strontium-90, and that would not have been safe. And that's the number I was talking about, that 10 or so of those tanks would equal the entire amount of strontium that was delivered 2 years ago, and that's going to become a persistent problem and hang around longer in the food chain. The other point, too, is while most of these isotopes we've talked about move quickly with the currents, there is still a small fraction, and a small fraction of a big number is a significant amount of cesium in the seafloor sediments, and that's going to be there for many years, if not decades. So while the ocean dilution process goes on, there's also a concentration into things that settle to the bottom, and that's probably one reason why the bottom fish in particular, the ones that live on that material, the plants and critters down there, they tend to be the highest in some of these radionuclides. So we have to think about that whole pathway into the ocean before we consider what we're going to release and how much.
Per Petersen, there's all kinds of questions raised here about nuclear power universally, but in particular, maybe we just shouldn't be building nuclear power plants on earthquake fault lines in tsunami country on the coast of the Pacific, any ocean at all.
Well, if you take a look at the situation, there was knowledge in Japan 10 years, more than a decade in advance of this accident, that large tsunamis are possible. Sort of the tragedy is that no action was taken to upgrade the defenses. And in fact, that was common across all the infrastructure. 20,000 people perished in that tsunami. So indeed, there's problems there that need to get fixed.
Per Petersen, chair of the Department of Nuclear Engineering at UC Berkeley in California. Thanks so much for joining us, Per.
You're welcome.
Yoichi Funabashi in Tokyo at the Rebuild Japan Initiative Foundation. Mr. Funabashi, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you. Thank you.
Ken Busler at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute. Thank you for joining us, Ken.
My pleasure.
Tomorrow in this hour, we'll talk about Congress and Syria, what it's going to do. We'll look at the very complicated battle lines there, political, strategic, moral, on Capitol Hill, looking at Syria and potential intervention. Join us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.